what her shining bones foretold, shimmering through her skin. She knew that glow. Only one thing on earth could make that glimmer. Radium. She went back to Dr. Humphreys and told him what she'd seen, how much pain she was in. And there, at the Orange Orthopedic Hospital, she said, "I heard Dr. Humphreys talking with another doctor. He told the doctor I was suffering from radium poisoning. That is the first I knew of it." Edna was a peaceful and resigned woman. She said later, "I'm religious. Perhaps that is why I'm not angry at anyone for what has occurred." But that didn't mean she didn't feel it was unjust. She went on, "I feel that someone should have warned us. None of us knew that paint paste was dangerous. We were only girls, 15, 17, and 19 years old." Maybe that innate sense of injustice was why, in June 1927, only a month after receiving her diagnosis, Edna and Louis Hussman made their way to Raymond Berry. There were 5 of them now. 5 girls crying out for justice. 5 girls fighting for their cause. Grace, Catherine, Quinta, Albina, and Edna. The newspapers went mad, inventing memorable monikers to define this new quintet. And so, in the summer of 1927, it became official. The case of the 5 women doomed to die had now begun. 25. The company executives, it would be fair to say, were taken completely by surprise by the 5 lawsuits. In fact, they dubbed it a conspiracy, cooked up by what they termed Berry's outfit. Their previous unshakable confidence in rejecting all pleas for clemency had been based upon the fact that the statute of limitations had made them, in their eyes, invincible. But now, with Berry's adroit interpretation of the law, they were left scrambling for their defense. It was, perhaps, inevitable who they would blame. The plaintiffs, the firm alleged in their reply to the girls' claims, were guilty of contributory negligence in failing to exercise due care and precaution for their safety. And the corporation went further. It denied that the girls were ever instructed to lip point. It denied any woman in the studio did. It denied the radium powder clung to them. On and on, denial after denial, for pages and pages of legalese. The company admitted only one thing. It gave no warning. That was because it denied that radium was dangerous. Such denials, such outright lies, one might say, comprised its written rejoinder through the law. Yet that was only the start of the firm's attempt to take control of the situation. Now faced with the women squaring up to it in court, it fought back behind their backs. Miss Rooney, the former forelady of USRC, who was a good friend of Edna Hussman, was surprised when one of her erstwhile bosses suddenly appeared at Luminite and asked to speak to her. At first, she chatted happily with the visiting executive about the girls who had worked under her management, sharing intimate details of how they were getting on. The executive, thrilled, noted she gave him considerable information. It seems both the firm and the former forelady totally underestimated the strength of will of Grace Fryer. Miss Rooney says that she feels certain that Grace Fryer was urged into the suit by the lawyers, a company memo said. They little knew that, without Grace's 2-year fight to find an attorney, none of this would be happening. The company, in fact, started to suspect not just the lawyers, but a former friend of stabbing it in the back. Miss Rooney seems to have reason to believe that Dr. von Serhotsky was in back of all these cases, the memo noted. I certainly think we should get a line on what von Serhatsky is doing and where he is. The executive who conducted these informal chats with Miss Rooney came not once, not twice, but three times to her workplace to grill her about the girls. By the third visit, it seems she had cottoned on to what was happening. Miss Rooney claimed to have no further information this morning, noted the executive's final memo on the subject. Have an idea that she is merely shutting up on information for fear of doing her friend harm. But it was of no consequence. The company had got what it needed, and there were other sources of information easily to hand. For the firm now paid private detectives to follow the five girls, looking for dirt on them that it could present in court. Barry perhaps suspected that such underhanded tactics would be employed, given his decision to lead with Grace's case. Yet despite the lily-white innocence of Grace Fryer, it didn't mean that any dirt kicked up didn't stick. There was that old rumor, not even a rumor, a cold, hard fact in black and white, printed on Amelia Maggia's death certificate. She had died of syphilis. So who was to say that all these other girls, who had once worked alongside a girl of her sort, weren't touched by the same Cupid's disease? The rumors wafted around the streets of Orange, sidling as close to the girls as a second skin, just as the radium dust had once done. You know how in small towns people gossip, a relative of Grace later said. USRC had not forgotten that Grace had once proposed a $5,000 settlement. When the firm filed its legal response to Barry, there was a final paragraph included. "Kindly let us have your rock-bottom figure in settlement," the firm's lawyers wrote. "Do not let us dicker. Give us your very best offer." As it was his job to do, Barry put the idea to Grace. One can imagine her response. Barry duly wrote back to USRC's legal team, which now comprised three separate firms, some of which were representing the company's insurers who would have to pay out if the girls won. "So far as settlement is concerned, Grace does not desire to make any proposition. In other words, we will see you in court." Barry immediately threw himself into building his case. He quickly met the girls' allies, Wiley, Hamilton, Hoffman, Martland, Humphreys, and von Serhatsky, and spent a lot of time reading their notes and interviewing them. Wiley gave him a damning account of all she had learned. "Although its employees were falling sick," she said, "the corporation did nothing. USRC has done everything it could to obscure the issue and render proper relief to its employees impossible." Learning of the cover-up of the Drinker report, Barry immediately grasped the impact of such double-dealing for his case and wrote to Cecil Drinker to request that he give evidence to help the women. But Drinker responded via his secretary that he does not care to make testimony. Barry would spend all summer trying to change his mind, but in the end, he was forced to issue a formal court summons. Drinker wasn't the only doctor not keen to testify. "While I thoroughly sympathize with the girls," wrote Martland, "I cannot take sides in a civil suit." Martland disliked lawyers and had no desire to get caught up in a legal battle. As much as he enjoyed a Sherlock Holmes mystery, he was not a fan of courtroom drama. As Martland's testimony was not certain, Barry would not give up trying to persuade him. Barry started hunting for another specialist who could take new breath tests of the girls to prove they were radioactive. But try as he might, he hit dead end after dead end. He found one specialist in Boston who was willing to assist, but the girls were not well enough to travel. In the other camp, meanwhile, USRC was having no such problems, as Flynn was still acting as its expert, and not just for them, as Barry soon discovered. Barry had now learned of the Waterbury Clock Company cases of radium poisoning. Essentially, their existence proved that his client's disease was occupational. Consequently, Barry wrote to the Workmen's Compensation Commission in Connecticut, the state in which the watch firm was based, looking for evidence he could cite in court. But the commission's response was totally unexpected. Had anybody in this vicinity suffered an occupational disease, its officer wrote, I should have had it brought to my attention, as occupational diseases have been compensable in this state for several years. No claims have been filed with me. I have heard a number of rumors such as you have, but know nothing about them. It was a conundrum. Connecticut law had a much more favorable statute of limitations of 5 years, which was just about long enough for a dial painter to discover she had radium poisoning before bringing a lawsuit. By now, at least 3 dial painters had died in Waterbury, and others were ill. Had not one of their families filed suit? They had not. And there was a very good reason why. Dr. Frederick Flynn. Flynn had enjoyed access to the Waterbury girls almost from when they began falling ill. He was given privileged admittance to the workforce, and the girls not only knew him, but trusted him. When he told them they were in perfect health, they believed him. And once radium poisoning was discovered, Flynn became willing to play a two-faced role. To the dial painters, he presented himself as a concerned medical expert, whereas for the company, he persuaded dial painters to accept settlements that explicitly freed the company from further liability. And this was the reason that not one case had been filed with the Compensation Commission. Any claims that might have been raised had been quietly settled by the firm. There was one obvious reason for the difference in the Waterbury Clock Company's approach compared with that of USRC, and the clue is in its name. As Waterbury was a clock company and not an out-and-out radium firm, agreeing to settlements, and in so doing tacitly admitting that the paint had harmed the girls, didn't affect its wider business, for it didn't make money from selling radium. And so, when its employees started dying, the company simply settled any cases that came up, using the gentle mediations of Dr. Flynn. In these negotiations, wrote one commentator, Flynn held the upper hand. He knew what he wanted, and the women he dealt with were invariably young, unsophisticated, vulnerable, and without the benefit of legal counsel. Had the Waterbury women taken some legal advice, they could have discovered what Barry well knew, that under Connecticut law, many of them might well have found justice, thanks to the more generous 5-year statute. It is to be noted, however, that the statute was 5 years only at the time of the discovery of radium poisoning. Following the emergence of the girls' cases, the law was rewritten in order to shorten it. With the good doctor's intervention, the company spent an average of $5,600, $75,000, per affected woman. But this figure is skewed by a handful of high settlements. Most victims received less than this average. Some, insultingly, were offered only 2-digit sums, such as, in one shocking case, $43.75, $606 for a woman's death. If one squinted at the situation and tried really hard, one could say that Flynn did the Waterbury girls a favor. He certainly saw it that way, intervening to save them the trouble of bringing a lawsuit. But the company and Flynn held all the cards, and Flynn hadn't finished with what Martland called his double-dealing and two-faced shenanigans. For even though Flynn had now been forced to acknowledge the existence of radium poisoning, it didn't mean that all the girls who fell sick suffered from it. And so, as Flynn continued to run his tests on the Waterbury women, he continued to find no positive cases of radium poisoning. Not one. Not in 1925, not in 1926, not in 1927. Only in the fading months of 1928 would he concede, at last, that five girls might be affected. He told one worker, Catherine Moore, on 8 separate occasions that there was not a single trace of radium in her body. She later died from radium poisoning. Barry, hearing back from the commission, knowing nothing of Flynn's work at Waterbury, was completely stumped by the lack of evidence. But his new friend Alice Hamilton quickly realized what had gone on and filled him in. With the cases settled quietly by Flynn, of course there had been no evidence, no publicity, no Department of Labor knocking on the clock company's door, no lawyers involved at all. Just a tidy sum passed across a desk, and a grateful recipient who took it. It was all hush-hush. None of it helped Raymond Barry. From the beginning, Barry was very interested in Dr. Flynn. He had learned from the girls about his declarations of their good health, declarations that had confused them, and for some girls taken the wind out of their sails when it came to filing suit. Barry thus decided, as early as August 1927, to dig a little deeper into Dr. Flynn. His inquiries soon unearthed a shocking piece of news. Dr. Flynn had been examining the girls, taking blood, reading their X-rays. He had been arranging medical treatment and writing to the women on the letter-headed paper of the College of Physicians and Surgeons. "I understood," said Grace's physician, Dr. McCaffrey, who'd arranged her examination with Flynn, "that Dr. Flynn was an M.D. But now, when Barry asked the authorities to look into exactly who Flynn was, he received the following letter from the New Jersey Board of Medical Examiners. "Our records do not show the issuance of a license to practice medicine and surgery, or any branch of medicine and surgery, to Frederick B. Flynn." Flynn was not a medical doctor. His degree was in philosophy. He was, as the Consumers League put it, a fraud of frauds. 26. Ottawa, Illinois, August 1927. Ella Cruz slammed the screen door of her house on Clinton Street and made her way down the few steps outside. She called goodbye to her mom, Nellie, as she went, but her voice was not as spirited as it once had been. Ella didn't know what was wrong with her. She had always been strong and robust before, but now she felt tired all the time. She started walking to work, taking her bearings, as always, from the spire of St. Columba, which was only a block or two from her home. Ella and her family, Mom, Nellie, Dad, James, and little brother, John, regularly attended services at the Catholic Church, like most everybody she worked with. Nellie's reply to her, as she said goodbye, had been quiet, too. But then her mom disapproved of Ella being a dial painter. "I never wanted Ella to work there," she used to say, shaking her head. "But it's a clean place, and they're a jolly bunch of girls." Clinton Street was only a couple of blocks from the art studio, too, so even with her new snail-pace gait, Ella was soon there. She made her way up the school steps with all the other girls arriving for work. There was Catherine Wolfe, walking with that slight limp she'd recently developed. Marie Becker, talking, as ever, a mile a minute. Mary Vicini, Ruth Thompson, and Sadie Prey. Peg Looney was already at her desk when Ella entered the studio, as conscientious as always. Ella said hello to them all. She was a popular young woman. In 1927, Mary Ellen Cruz, as she'd been christened by her parents, was 24, the same age as Catherine Wolfe. Her glossy chestnut hair was cut into a fashionable bob, which ended daringly short at her cheekbones. It was finished with a dramatic fringe that swept across her flawless skin. She wore her eyebrows neatly plucked, and had a shy smile that brought out a dimple in her left cheek. She settled at her wooden desk and picked up her brush. Lip, dip, paint. It was a familiar routine by now, as she'd started working there when she was about 20. She worked 25 days a month, 8 hours a day, with no paid vacations. Boy, she felt like taking a holiday now, though. She was tired and run down, and her jaw felt sore. It made no sense. She was in excellent health normally. Ella had started seeing a doctor about 6 months back, but even though she'd gone to a couple of different physicians, none had been able to help. It was just like Peg Looney. She'd had a tooth pulled recently, but she said her dentist couldn't make it heal. Ella looked up as she heard Mr. Reed come into their room, watching as he paced up and down on one of his infrequent inspections. He had a certain swagger to his walk these days, but why wouldn't he? He now ran the joint, the superintendent at last, ever since Miss Murray had died of cancer back in July. Ella turned her attention back to her dials. No time to waste. It was hard work today, though. All that summer she had complained of pains in her hands and legs, and it was tough to keep up with the delicate painting when her knuckles were so sore. She took a breather just for a minute and rested her head in her hands. But that also worried her. There was a hard ridge under her chin. She didn't know what it was or why it had suddenly appeared in the past few weeks, but it felt most peculiar. Still, at least it was Friday. Ella wondered what the girls would be up to this weekend. Maybe Peg's boyfriend Chuck would have people over at the shack, or there'd be a plan to catch a movie at the Roxy. Her finger absent-mindedly stroked the small pimple that had appeared on her usually perfect skin a day or two earlier. It was on her left cheek, right by her dimple. When it had appeared, she'd picked at it, and it had started to swell. She could feel the pain and pressure under her fingertips. Hopefully her skin would clear up before any parties started. She tried to concentrate on her work all morning, but found it harder and harder. No parties for her this weekend, that was for sure. In fact, she thought suddenly, no work either. She was done in, and she was done for today. She took her tray of dials up to Mr. Reed and said she had to go home sick. It was less than 10 minutes before she was back on Clinton Street as the St. Columba bells tolled the hour of noon. She told her mom she wasn't feeling well and probably went to bed. The next day, remembered her mother, Nellie, we went to the doctor. That little pimple had swelled up on her daughter's face, and she wanted to get it checked. But there was nothing serious about her condition, and the doctor was in convivial spirits as he chatted with the Cruises. Ella told him how her mom was always scared of her working at Radium Dial, and he retorted with a hearty chuckle, That's all bunk. There's not a cleaner place. And so Ella and Nellie went back to Clinton Street. Ella may have skipped church on the Sunday. She certainly wasn't well enough for work come Monday morning. On Tuesday, August 30th, her mother called out a physician again. He opened the pimple, but nothing came out. He then left them to it. It appeared that whatever was causing Ella's sickness was a mystery. A mystery it may have been, but not right, was what Ella Cruz knew it to be. That pimple, that little pimple, just kept swelling and swelling. It was incredibly painful. Nothing she or her mom or even the doctor did could halt it. It was an infection that was unstoppable. Her face became badly swollen. She had a fever, too. The next day, recalled Nellie, the doctor looked at her face again and ordered her to the hospital. Ella was admitted to Ottawa City Hospital on August 31st. But still that spot got bigger and bigger until you couldn't call it a pimple anymore. It wasn't even a boil. It went way beyond that. Ella's neat haircut still sprouted from her head, as fashionable as ever, but the girl below, in just a few short days, became unrecognizable. Septic poisoning set in, and her pretty face and head turned black. "She suffered the awfulest pain," remembered her mother in horror. "The awfulest pain I ever saw anyone suffer." Ella was her only daughter. Nellie kept a bedside vigil as long as the doctors would let her, even though the person in the bed didn't look like Ella anymore. But she was still Ella. She was still her daughter, and she was alive, and she needed her mom. Midnight, September 3rd. Saturday night slipped into Sunday morning, and Ella's condition declined. As she lay in bed, her system septic, her head swollen and black, her face unrecognizable, the poison in her body did its worst. At 4:30 a.m. on Sunday, September 4th, her death came suddenly. She had been at work painting dials just the week before. All she'd had was a little spot on her face. How had it come to this? The doctors filled in her death certificate. Streptococcic poisoning, they wrote as the cause of death. Contributory cause, infected face. On September 6th, Nellie and James Cruz traced the familiar path to St. Columba to bury their daughter. Miss Cruz's death, reported the local paper, came as a shock to all of her friends and family. It was a shock. It left a hole in a family that could never be filled. Her parents said, many years later, "Life has never been the same since she went." Ella's obituary mentioned only one other detail as it mourned this youthful Ottawa girl who had lived there most of her life, who'd had friends, been popular, worn her hair in a bob, and lived her too few days in the shadow of the church spire. She had been employed, the paper noted, at the radium dial. 27. Newark, New Jersey, 1927. The news of Flynn's non-medical degree was shocking to all. Wiley, reeling from being duped, called him a real villain. Hamilton wrote to Flynn, urging him to consider very seriously the stand you are taking. But Flynn was nonplussed. He replied to Hamilton, "What you mean by my recent conduct is beyond my ken." He seems to have been unperturbed by Barry's discovery of his real degree. In his eyes, he was still an expert in industrial hygiene, just as Hoffman, a statistician, could also be called a specialist in that field, and he had done nothing wrong. Hamilton was frustrated by Flynn's glib reply. "He is impossible to deal with," she exclaimed. Barry, meanwhile, reported Flynn to the authorities for practicing medicine without a license. Separately from the Flynn matter, Hamilton now equipped Barry with what would prove to be an all-important secret weapon, a personal connection with Walter Lippmann and the world. The World was arguably the most powerful newspaper in America at the time. It promised to never lack sympathy with the poor and always remain devoted to public welfare. So the Dial Painter's case was a perfect cause célèbre for the paper to get behind. Lippmann was one of its leading writers. He would become the paper's editor in 1929 and later be deemed by several sources as the most influential journalist of the 20th century. To have him in the girls' camp was something of a coup. Immediately, Barry got a taste of just what Lippmann could do. USRC, as was to be expected, had cited the statute of limitations in its defense. The company argued that the cases should be thrown out of court before the firm's guilt could even be examined. But Lippmann was quick to give his own interpretation of that kind of legal trickery in the world, calling the attempt by the corporation to take refuge in the statute intolerable and despicable. "It is scarcely thinkable," he wrote, "that the court will not agree with counsel for the complainant." He was right, in a way. The court did not agree with the company. Instead, the girls' cases, which had all been consolidated into one case to avoid duplicate hearings, were transferred to the Court of Chancery, where their cases would be presented and a ruling given on whether Barry's interpretation of the statute held. Assuming he and the girls were triumphant, there would then be a second trial, which would rule on whether the company was at fault. The Court of Chancery was dubbed the Court of King's Conscience. It was where pleas for mercy that might be left unanswered through a strict reading of the law were heard. The trial date was set for January 12, 1928. There was much to do before then. Barry had at last found a specialist who would run the new radioactivity tests on the girls. Elizabeth Hughes was a physicist and former assistant to von Serhotsky. The tests were planned for November 1927. Barry knew, however, that whatever Mrs. Hughes found, the results would be questioned in court. USRC, in fact, had already said, "We should also like to have a physical examination of the plaintiffs by our doctor," and Barry anticipated that there would be some dispute over the tests. The results could be variable, no doubt. A humid day could skew the readings, and even different doctors looking at the same figures could interpret them contrarily. Barry's problem thus mirrored that of Dr. Martland in 1925. How could he prove it was radium that was killing the Dial Painters? There was only really one way to do that, and it wasn't something Barry could ask of his clients. For the only way to extract radium from a victim's bones, to demonstrate incontrovertibly that radium was present, was to reduce those bones to ash. "The deposit of radium," commented Martland, "can be removed only by cremating the bone and then boiling the ash in hydrochloric acid." No, this was nothing that Grace or Edna or Catherine or the Maggia sisters could help with. Except for maybe one of the Maggia girls, Molly. It was shortly after 9 a.m. that the men came to Rosedale Cemetery on October 15, 1927. They made their way through the rows of memorials until they stopped at one particular grave. They erected a tent over it and removed the headstone. Then they worked to uncover the coffin, heaving sodden earth out of the hole until they unveiled a nondescript wooden box which held Amelia, Molly, Magia, the girl, so people said, who had died of syphilis. The men ran ropes under it, then attached stronger silver chains. It was raised just slightly to free it from water that had seeped in around it as a result of the recent rains. Then they waited for the officials to arrive. Barry had arranged with the radium company that they would all converge at 3:30 p.m. exactly. At 3 o'clock p.m., the specialists from the company arrived at Molly's grave. There were six of them, including Vice President Barker and the ubiquitous Dr. Flynn. Prudently, Barry had arranged for a special investigator to be present for the morning's activities. He, now, watched the company men closely as they milled outside the tent. At 3:30 p.m., as specified, Barry walked up to the grave with Mrs. Hughes, Dr. Martland, and a cohort of New York doctors who would lead on conducting the autopsy. There were 13 officials in all, gathered together to witness Molly's exhumation. Standing awkwardly among the doctors and lawyers were three other men, James MacDonald and James Larice, Molly's sister's husbands, and her father, Valerio. The family hadn't protested when Barry had put the idea to them. Molly's body could provide perfect corroborating evidence for the Dial Painter's fight in court. Even after all these years, she could still help her sisters. After the arrival of Barry's team, preparations were made for raising the coffin. Curtains were drawn around, and the entire party went inside the tent. The grave workers heaved on the ropes and chains. Slowly, Molly rose the 6 feet to the surface. The outer box was in bad condition and easily pulled apart. The casket was likewise ready to fall apart. Despite the dim fall day, the coffin seemed to glow with an unnatural light. There were unmistakable signs of radium. The inside of the coffin was aglow with the soft luminescence of radium compounds. Someone leant over the glowing coffin and pulled a silver nameplate from the rotten wood. Amelia Magia, it read. They showed it to Valerio for identification. He nodded. Yes, that was the one. That was the one the family had chosen for his child. As soon as Molly's identity was confirmed, the top and sides of the casket were removed. And there she was. There was Molly Magia, back from the grave, in her white dress and her black leather pumps, just as she had been dressed on the day she was buried in 1922. The body, observers noted, was in a good state of preservation. They removed her carefully from her coffin, placed her gently in a wooden box, and then took her by automobile to a local undertaking parlor. At 4:50 p.m., her autopsy would begin. At 4:50 p.m., Amelia Magia would finally have the chance to speak. There is no dignity in death. The doctors started with her upper jawbones, which were removed in several pieces. They had no need to do the same with her lower jaw, for it was no longer present, having been lifted out in life. They sawed through her spine, her head, her ribs. They scraped her bones with a knife to prepare them for the next steps. And there was, somehow, a kind of ritualistic care in their steady tasks as they washed her bones in hot water, dried, and reduced them to grayest white ash. Some bones they put to the X-ray film test, others they ignited to ash, and then tested the ash itself for radioactivity. When they checked the X-ray film, days later, there was Molly's message from beyond the grave. She had been trying to speak for so long. Now, at last, there was someone listening. Her bones had made white pictures on the ebony film. Her vertebrae glowed in vertical white lights, like a regiment of matches slowly burning into black. They looked like rows of shining dial painters walking home from work. The pictures of her skull, meanwhile, with her jawbone missing, made her mouth stretch unnaturally wide, as though she was screaming, screaming for justice through all these years. There was a smudge of dark where her eye had once been, as though she was looking out, staring accusingly, setting straight a lie that had blackened her name. There was, the examining doctors said, no evidence of disease, in particular, no evidence of syphilis. Innocent. Each and every portion of tissue and bone tested, the doctors concluded, gave evidence of radioactivity. It wasn't Cupid's disease, as the gossipmongers charged. It was radium. The doctor's autopsy findings gathered wide publicity. The girl's fight for justice was slowly becoming famous. And it was this publicity that now brought another girl to Barry's office, though she did not sign with him at that time. Ella Eckert, Molly Maggia's friend, the fun-loving girl with frizzy blonde hair who had laughed her head off at so many company picnics, now called on the Newark lawyer in the fall of 1927. She was in better health than any of the five women suing, but she nevertheless told Barry, "I have spent at least $200, $2,724, for X-rays, blood tests, medicine, and medical attention, all to no avail." She'd had a fall at work at Bamberger's the year before and been forced to give up her job as her shoulder had never healed. Indeed, Barry could see that her arm was badly swollen, extending from the shoulder down to the hand. She said she was in severe pain and begged him to help her. And that help was not just for her. Ella Eckert had taken her fun-loving ways to what were then considered extremes. She'd had a son with a married man who had since disappeared, and now she was bringing up the boy on her own. She couldn't afford to be out of work or to get sick. Her son needed her. Barry knew their paths would cross again. In the meantime, his pace of work sped up. An important date was November 14, 1927. This was when the first testimony was taken in the girl's trial as part of a deposition. Barry had issued his formal summons to Dr. Drinker. Now the reluctant doctor gave his evidence under oath. It was at this juncture that Barry met his main adversary, Edward A. Markley, the attorney for the radium firm's insurance company, who was leading USRC's defense. Markley was almost 6 feet tall, with brown hair and eyes, which he framed with glasses. His father had been a judge, and he was the eldest son in his family. He had all the suave confidence and self-possession such attributes would give. He was some 6 years older than Barry, with all the added experience that implied. From the moment the deposition taking started, Barry realized it was not going to be an easy ride. He was trying to admit all the Drinker evidence, the blinkered, blustering letters that Roeder had sent to justify suppressing the Drinker report, the firm's false claims to the Department of Labor. To every single question, every single item of evidence, the USRC lawyers fought back. "We object to the question," said Markley, "on the ground that the purpose is immaterial." "We object," said Stryker, "to the witness stating what he told Mr. Roeder." They even shut down Drinker himself. "I should like to make a statement for the purpose of the record on my side relative to this," the doctor began calmly. "Before you do that, we object to it," jumped in Markley, before Drinker could proceed. The lawyers deemed the collection of authentic letters a scurrilous statement of rumors, and took a clever line of questioning with the pioneering scientist and his colleagues. To each of the three investigators who had authored the Drinker report, they put the question, "Had you had any experience in investigating radium poisoning?" The answer from all, of course, was none. The implication being, how could the word of such inexperienced experts be taken seriously? Only Catherine Drinker pointed out the obvious. "This is the first time the disease was discovered." Barry was not daunted by all this, however. Submitting the Drinker's report, he said cheekily, "It is offered as the best evidence we have and will be used in the event Mr. Roeder has mislaid the original." The company lawyers merely responded, "If the original is used, it is, of course, subject to our objections." January was going to prove a tough battle, that was for sure. Before they got there, however, an unexpected event took everyone by surprise. Barry had been concerned about the young woman who'd visited him earlier in the year, for Ella Eckert, he had heard, had been near death in the orthopedic hospital for weeks now. She had the usual symptoms of radium poisoning, the anemia, the white shadow through her bones. Yet, despite these telltale signs, Dr. Martland commented, "This case is very puzzling and not as clear-cut as the others." On December 13, 1927, Ella Eckert died. Martland traced her name on the list of the doomed. D is for death. She'd had an operation earlier that day on her swollen shoulder. And herein lay the solution to her mystery. For when the doctors cut her open, they found a calcareous formation was attached and had permeated the entire shoulder region. It was a growth of considerable size. Such a growth was new to Martland, to all the doctors. No dial painter, so far as they knew, had ever presented such a thing. Radium was a clever poison. It masked its way inside its victim's bones. It foxed the most experienced physicians. And like the expert serial killer it was, it had now evolved its modus operandi. Ella had developed what was called a sarcoma, a cancerous tumor of the bone. She was the first known dial painter to die from such a thing, but she would not be the last. Her death shocked the five girls suing. Her decline had been so fast. Yet it also gave them even more inspiration for the fight that lay ahead. On January 12, 1928, the trial of the decade would begin. 28. "I could hardly sleep the night before the court hearing," Catherine Sharb wrote, "for I had been waiting for ages, it seemed, to see this very day." She was not alone. When the five women, on a frosty January day, arrived at the Court of Chancery, they found themselves surrounded. Newspapermen crowded around, flashing cameras in their eyes, and then packed the seats of the gallery inside. Barry hoped the girls would be ready for what lay ahead. He had prepped them all as he could, calling the five women together 2 days ago to go through their testimony. Yet the women's mental strength was only part of the equation, and anyone could see that their physical health was failing. The past 6 months had not been kind to them. "The condition of certain of the girls," Barry wrote, "is truly deplorable." He was most concerned about Albina Larice. She could not extend her left leg more than 4 inches. She could not even put on her own shoes and stockings because she could not bend over. Her medical prognosis, along with Edna Hussman's, was now deemed the worst. Yet it was not the loss of her health that plagued her. "I have lost," Albina mourned, "2 children because I'm this way." Only the previous fall, Barry knew from what the doctors had told him, she'd lost a 3rd baby, a baby who, if things had been different, might well have lived. She'd been so delighted when she found out she was pregnant, but Albina's happiness did not last long. For when her doctors discovered her condition, they would not permit development of the child due to her health. They ordered her to have a therapeutically induced abortion. "I've been so discouraged at times," Albina confided, "that I've thought about taking gas and ending it all." Dr. Humphreys had said that radium poisoning destroys his patient's will to live. Barry could only hope that the women, on this day, could find the will to fight. Edna Hussman was the first to give evidence. Lewis almost had to carry his wife to the witness stand. His beautiful blonde Edna, when seen in snapshot, looked as modelesque as ever, striking a pose with one leg casually crossed in front of the other. But appearances were deceptive. She could no longer move her legs apart, for her hips had locked in place at that abnormal angle. She had also lost the use of her right arm. She could not even raise it to take the oath. The judge overseeing proceedings was Vice Chancellor John Backus, a very experienced man in his mid-60s. Barry must have been hopeful for a sympathetic hearing, for Backus's own father had died after being injured in a rolling mill. Backus wore a bushy mustache and glasses. He looked kindly on Edna as she prepared to give her testimony. Barry eased her in slowly, just as they'd rehearsed. Edna concentrated on him, answering simple questions about where she lived and how she was now a housewife, although, as she said outside the court, "I cannot keep my little home." She explained, "I do what I can, but my husband does most of the work." Edna was tired. "The worst thing I have to put up with is not being able to sleep at night because of the pain in my hips," she revealed. So it didn't help when, only 8 questions in, as she began to outline the nature of her work at USRC, the lawyers for the corporation cut in with the first of their many objections. Barry was expecting it. On January 4th, he'd taken another 3-hour deposition with the company lawyers present, this time from the Newark dentist, Dr. Barry. Once again, they'd questioned everything. Irene Rudolph's dental file had a note that read, "Recovery? Okay," which Barry explained meant that she had recovered from the anesthetic. The lawyers, however, said tartly, "Isn't the recovery here recovery from the treatment?" They asked the same question in different permutations at least 8 times before moving on. Edna Hussman, however, was not a professional man like Dr. Barry. She was a 26-year-old crippled housewife, and the company lawyer's aggressive tactics did them no favors. As they harangued her to remember dates and how frequently she had stumbled when her pains began, Bacchus interrupted their incessant questioning. "Of what importance is it?" he asked pointedly. Sympathy for Edna increased as her testimony continued. "I suffer," she told the court, "all the time." Barry's inexperience in court sometimes showed itself. Despite his brilliant mind, he was still in the early stages of his trial career, but he found the judge was willing to help him out. When Hoffman took the stand after Edna, Bacchus assisted Barry by helping him to phrase his questions. "What did he do to get the information, and what did he learn?" he prompted, and even stepping in to help when he anticipated an objection. On their cross-examination of Hoffman, the company lawyers tried the same tactic they'd used with the drinkers. "Is this the first time that you had occasion to consider the question of radium necrosis?" Markley asked the statistician, his tall frame pacing the courtroom as he fired off questions. "Yes, sir. Entirely new venture." "You had no knowledge, did you?" "Or nobody else," pointed out Hoffman. "I am asking you," Markley said, "to speak for yourself. Was this the first time you ever had anything to do with the subject?" "Yes, sir," Hoffman had to agree. Markley then tried to get Hoffman's evidence dismissed entirely. "I submit, Your Honor," he said with a condescending sneer, "that a mere statistician is not qualified in court to pass judgment." Yet Markley found that Bacchus was not playing ball. "I think he is a little more than that," retorted the judge. "I think you curbed him down some." All this time, the five women watched the drama unfold. They were flanked by the witnesses for the company, too. The chameleon-hued Dr. Flynn sat across from them in the courtroom. Grace felt calm inside, knowing she was up next. "Grace is so accustomed to talking of disease and decay," wrote a journalist of Miss Fryer, "that she can tell you of these deaths without flickering an eyelash." Still, there must have been a few butterflies as the court sergeant-at-arms tenderly assisted her to the witness stand. This was it, Grace thought. This was her chance to tell her story. She sat somewhat awkwardly in the chair. Her metal back brace chafed her skin, and a fresh bandage clung to her jaw following a recent operation. Yet the slim young woman with neat dark hair and intelligent eyes now composed herself as she began her testimony. "We were instructed to point the brush with our lips," she said. "Did all the girls do it that way?" asked Bacchus. "All I ever saw do it," answered Grace. "Were you ever told at any time not to put the brush in your mouth?" queried Barry, cutting to the heart of the matter. "Only on one occasion," she said. "Dr. von Serhotsky was passing through, and when he saw me put the brush to my lips, he told me not to do it."
"What else did he say?"
"He said it would make me sick." Her answers were concise and informative. She and Barry had an instant repartee, with question and answer flicking back and forth, slickly, just as they had planned. Yet Barry gave her room, too, to describe her suffering, so that everyone could hear what the company had done. "I have had my jaws curetted 17 times, said Grace, simply, "with pieces of the jawbone removed. Most of my teeth have been removed. My spine is decaying, and one bone in my foot is totally destroyed."
It was horrifying to listen to. Many in the courtroom were in tears. No wonder, when Markley made some smart comment, the judge snapped back at him, "If I find you guilty, I think you will be sorry," he said tartly. Given the warning, Markley approached Grace's cross-examination with some caution.